Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the critical phase that the P5+1 talks with Iran are in, hours before the deadline elapses, and speak with Joseph Cirincione, the president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. We will discuss his article at the Huffington Post, How to Know the Iran Deal is a Good Deal, and Senator McCain's recent Senate speech calling on Israel to go rogue and start a war with Iran to prevent Obama's deal with Iran from happening. Then we'll discuss the HBO documentary Going Clear, Scientology and the Prison of Belief, that just aired with a shocking expose of this pseudo-religion that is revealed as a ruthless money-making operation which fleeces its followers while enslaving them and makes billions in tax-exempt profits that are at the disposal of the cult's secretive and sadistic leader, David Miscavige. John Sweeney, an investigative journalist with the BBC's flagship television program Panorama and author of The Church of Fear, Inside the Weird World of Scientology, joins us. Then finally, we will speak with Professor Marjorie Hershey, who teaches political science at Indiana State University and is the author of Party Politics in America. We will discuss how Indiana Governor Mike Pence's so-called religious freedom law has backfired, with his efforts to curry favor with the religious right for a possible White House run blowing up in his face. And joining us now is Joseph Cirincione, who's the president of the Plowshares Fund and the author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He previously directed nonproliferation and international policy programs at the Center for American Progress and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's also worked on the professional staffs of the House Committee on Armed Services and the Committee on Government Operations and has served as a staff director of the Bipartisan Military Reform Caucus. He has an article at the Huffington Post, How to Know the Iran Deal is a Good Deal. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joseph Cirincione.
Thank you very much, Ian. Nice to be back.
And, Joe, they're very close to a deal in Switzerland, clearly, although the Russian foreign minister is leaving the talks and apparently returning on Tuesday. So I guess you could make the assumption it won't be done until before Tuesday. But do you expect it to be finally done, even though there's some last-minute haggling going on?
Yes, there is a lot of brinksmanship here. And as they say, the toughest hour of negotiations is the last hour. You know, people are putting chips on the table, taking them off. If nobody misplays their hand, I think we're going to get a deal by the deadline of midnight, March 31st, because we're so close, and the people have invested so much in this, and most of the really difficult issues have been resolved. Most of the issues, for example, dealing with how to roll back and contain Iran's nuclear program, and we're down to a couple of issues of details and how exactly this would be rolled back, and most importantly, the pace and sequencing of sanctions relief. Those are tough, but I think they're solvable.
Well, from what I understand, the obstacles are no longer about enrichment-related issues, but more about the length of restrictions on Tehran's research and development of advanced centrifuges and the pace of lifting the sanctions. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, there's a couple. It depends how much detail you want to get into. The sanctions part is actually the toughest because that's the real money. That's when Iran would be rewarded for complying with the agreement and what restrictions we would have for snapping the sanctions back in place should they cheat. We are also concerned about R&D. Remember, these Iranian centrifuges are very old technology. They're 1970s designs that they got from the Pakistanis. They're very primitive. Nobody actually uses centrifuges like this anymore. So we don't want Iran doing research on more advanced centrifuges that are 10 times, 50 times more powerful. We don't want to be faced with suddenly them putting a whole new generation of machines in. We're negotiating exactly what the restrictions are. And there's some details about whether they'd be allowed to keep some centrifuges at the deep underground facility at Fort Doe. Most of their centrifuges are at another facility at Natanz. The Fort Doe facility is sensitive because Israeli bombs can't penetrate there. So the Israelis really want those centrifuges out. The Iranians have invested a lot of pride, a lot of money in putting them in, so we're looking for a creative compromise. And I think they hit one which is they can keep them in, but they can't use them to enrich uranium. They could use it for scientific purposes to purify other gases. And some of those gases, it turns out, like zinc and molybdenum, if used in those centrifuges, which contaminate them so bad, they couldn't be used for uranium enrichment again. So those are the kinds of details that are being worked out now.
So they have stockpiles of uranium hexafluoride, though, don't they?
Yeah, that's exactly right. They have about 8,000 kilograms of low-enriched uranium hexafluoride. And the problem with that is that if they were to feed that back into the centrifuges in a matter of months, maybe it's 6 months, maybe it's 12 months, they could make enough highly enriched uranium for a bomb. And with that amount, if they just kept going, they could probably make 6 bombs worth. So part of the deal is to slash that inventory from 8,000 kilograms. I've heard figures as low as 500. So cut it, you know, by 9/10. But where does it go then? The one plan is to get it out of the country, ship it to Russia, and have Russia convert it into fuel that would then be given back to the Iranians. But there are other ways to skin this cat. They could dilute it. They could convert it into fuel. It could be put in forms, kept under lock and key, so that they couldn't quickly, at least, use that to make a bomb.
Well, Joe Cirincione, I know some of the people involved in this negotiation, and I imagine you know them too, Gary Seymour and David Albright.
Well, Gary was with the White House. He's not been involved in these negotiations.
Right.
He left before that. And David works at an independent institute.
Right.
They both observe the negotiations, but aren't actually involved.
Right. Well, that's what I mean. They've observed them, and they know what's going on. And the one thing that I've always thought was absurd about opposition, whether it's from the Republicans in Congress or Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel, is that there's no other alternative put forth except bombing or ramping up more sanctions. And why does anybody in the world think that you can even put any more sanctions on Iran, and what good would they do?
Yeah, it's a very good point. Well, a lot of people are sort of, you know, pushing outside the negotiations, are pushing and trying to get the Obama administration to make the toughest deal possible, as if they needed any prodding. I mean, it's really a crazy idea that we're going to willingly give away concessions to the Iranians when we don't have to. I don't think these people never met Wendy Sherman, who's in charge of the negotiations for the State Department. I've negotiated with her, and I've gotten my clock cleaned. But so some of it's outside pressure, push, push, push. I think many of these people, once they see the deal, once it's done, I think they're going to be in favor of it for exactly what you say. It's however many problems there are with the negotiations, the deal, and it's not going to be perfect, the alternatives are hugely unattractive. If you don't get this deal, if the negotiations collapse and we're seen as the reason for it, well, then you're going to have a very hard time keeping the international sanctions in place. The Senate could pass a new sanctions bill, and they would be completely ineffective because our global partners, not just the Russians and the Chinese, but the Europeans, will walk away from us. And then you'll see a withering of the sanctions regime, more and more sales and business and oil sales going to Iran. And you'll see Iran now unconstrained in a nuclear program, able to start installing new centrifuges, more advanced centrifuges, enriching more uranium, and they'll be marching towards at least the capability of building a bomb, and that could lead to a war. And that is the most unattractive alternative of all, because a war with Iran would not be a pinprick attack. This would not be a couple of bombing raids over a facility. U.S. war planners have gamed this out. We have looked at this very, very closely, and we're talking about weeks of hundreds of sorties, killing thousands of people in Iran in the process. And if you think that Iran has a lot of influence in the region, a lot of proxies in the region, well, they are going to use that influence, use that proxies, and this would quickly become a regional war that would make the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan look like warm-up acts. I don't know any military leader who wants to undertake that war.
Well, I actually do, and what I'm referring to here, Joe, is that last Tuesday, Senator John McCain, speaking on the Senate floor, suggested that Israel should go rogue, and if they don't, they may not survive the next 22 months of the Obama presidency. And just quoting McCain's speech on the Senate floor last Tuesday, the Israelis will need to chart their own path for resistance. On the Iranian nuclear deal, they may have to go rogue. Let's hope their warnings have not been mere bluffs. This is an extraordinary. The John McCain is the head of the Senate Armed Services Committee. He's a former Republican presidential candidate. I cannot recall where anybody in that, of that authority has called for a foreign state to openly obstruct U.S. policy and initiate a catastrophic regional war.
It's breathtaking, actually. I agree with you. I wouldn't, although John McCain served honorably in the U.S. military, I wouldn't call him a military leader now. But it is an astonishing statement. It was bad enough that they invited the head of a country, Mr. Netanyahu, to come to Congress without consulting with the president. It was bad enough that 47 Republicans directly took foreign policy in their own hands and wrote a letter to the head of the Islamic Republic. But for a senator, a sitting senator, to actively be urging one of our allies to start a war that would almost immediately involve the United States is unconscionable. I've never seen anything like this. I'm astonished that he actually got away with this statement so far. Now it's only just coming to people's attention.
And you mentioned the previous efforts to scuttle the talks or at least undermine the president, both of which were pretty unprecedented. The head of another country being offered the most prestigious platform in the world, which is a joint session of Congress, to attack a sitting president. That's pretty unusual. And 47 Republican senators writing a letter to the head of state that the U.S. and the P5 plus one are negotiating with, basically saying that if you make this deal, we'll kill it at our first opportunity. That was pretty unprecedented. But now McCain's statement is adding even further to a whole new frontier of political partisan meddling, which is, I think, unprecedented. But let's try and focus on then on what's going on with Prime Minister Netanyahu. It's often said that for the Israeli right, Iranian nuclear bomb is an existential threat, even though Israel has one of the biggest nuclear arsenals in the world. Is it possible that the real threat to Netanyahu is this deal? Because if this deal happens, it's going to undercut entirely the situation vis-a-vis the Palestinians, where the Israelis will have no excuses. If the Iranians are going to join the international community and stop being spoilers, what is the point of not making a deal with the Palestinians?
Well, there have been many leaders of Israel who have been partners in the peace process, who have been willing and have tried to negotiate with the Palestinians. Mr. Netanyahu is not one of them. And I believe that part of his strong opposition to the Iranian deal and part of the reason he keeps raising this so much is to deflect attention from the Palestinian peace talks and the process that the U.S. has tried to get him to engage in ever since he's been prime minister in both Republican and Democratic presidents. And this has now come to a head, both with his comments during the election, that if you vote for him, he will make sure there's never a Palestinian state, and his rather weak attempts to walk back from that ever since the election. I think Mr. Netanyahu is looking at the real prospect of a shift in U.S. policy, one that will put more pressure on him to make a deal. And if you get a U.S.-Iranian deal, I mean, it's not going to be, you know, the beginning of a major realignment between the U.S. and Iran. We have lots of differences with Iran that have nothing to do with the deal, but it is going to take away what he has claimed has been the biggest threat. Because if you take a deal that prevents Iran from getting a bomb for at least 10 years, and then opens up the prospect of a permanent solution. You know, there's a lot of things you can do between now and 10 years. If the outline is correct, then you'll start to unfreeze the Iranian program. Well, then what is the threat that Mr. Netanyahu is going to have to deflect attention? And there really isn't any. And so it presents a problem for him. That's why I think you're seeing him and his American supporters really raise up the rhetoric against the deal now to near apocalyptic levels. It's just astonishing that you hear people talking about Iran as if they're Nazi Germany, and that Obama's Neville Chamberlain and Mr. Netanyahu's statement that all of humanity would be threatened by this deal. It's hyperbole that has gone beyond almost anything I've heard so far.
So could you turn that inside out, though? And is what, at the end of the day, when the inspectors go in, what do you think they're going to find in Iran, Joe Cerincione? Because it seems to me that they did get these primitive centrifuges, which were originally stolen by Aku Khan from a Dutch company, right, a long time back in the 60s. And my understanding is that they also got blueprints for a Chinese-designed nuclear weapon. But the fact that that country has suffered so much because of sanctions to hide this program would indicate that there's something there, at least to my mind. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, is it possible at the end of the day, the there that's there doesn't amount to much?
Yeah. This is two things. What do they have right now, and what did they do in the past? And we have a very good idea of what there is right now, in part because we negotiated with them. And back in November 2013, we got an interim deal that increased the inspections on the Iranian program. So we now have more inspectors there than we ever had, with better access. So you have international inspectors from the International Atomic Energy Agency with daily visits to the Iranian nuclear sites. I just was with the Director General of the IAEA, Mr. Amano, last week, and he told an international gathering of nonproliferation specialists that with the current authorities they have, they're confident that they can detect any diversion of material, any effort to shift material over to military purposes on the day it happens or the following day or certainly within the week. And with this new deal, what we're going to have is a much stricter level. From everything I've heard, this will be the most intrusive inspection regime ever put in place for an agreement of this kind. So we're going to get to know a lot more and have fairly high confidence, especially coupled with their own independent national intelligence means, which can see a lot of things that the inspectors can't. I think we're going to have pretty good confidence that if Iran tries to sneak out or break out or creep out of this plan, we'll get them. But then there's the question of the past. The National Intelligence Estimate of the United States finds that it's likely that Iran engaged in weapons work before 2003, but around 2003, that program ended as a formal program. What were they doing in the 80s and 90s? We don't know for sure, but the circumstantial evidence is pretty strong. They're working on weapons design. It's not clear how far they got, but they didn't build a bomb. There's no evidence that there's a bomb in the basement someplace. Why don't the Iranians admit that? Because it's hugely embarrassing to them. They've been denying it all these years. So they're not going to admit to any of these past history until after we have a deal, until after there's a framework that can sort of offer them some kind of amnesty for coming clean. And then we'll have to help them find a face-saving way out, that it was unauthorized work or something like that. I personally don't believe that any of the work that they did in the past poses a current threat to the United States. But we do want to know what they did. We do want to have a full record. And I think this deal will help us get this record. One thing's for sure, if you don't have a deal, you won't have any inspections, and you will never find out what Iran did in the past.
And these so-called PMDs, you're talking about possible military dimensions, once they're revealed and once there's a deal, which obviously makes sense, that we'll find out what's in the deal is sufficient to curtail them. One of the criticisms is that you may slow them down for 10 years, but then they're going to come back and build a bomb in 10 years. That's pretty much the Republican and Israeli line.
Yeah. So there's two things. In the history of uncovering past experiments with other countries. You know, South Africa had a secret program. South Korea conducted some experiments they weren't supposed to. You know, is that it takes some time to do this, and it takes an effort. So there's not going to be a dramatic TV show where they completely come clean. But I feel fairly confident that we can find out a lot more about this as time goes on. And the second thing is that it's true that parts of this deal will expire in 10 years. So Iran doesn't want to be held down indefinitely. But parts of it will never expire. The inspections, for example, are a permanent fixture. The ban on building a nuclear weapon is a permanent fixture of the agreement. And in the 10 years that we have, we can take on other measures. For example, we might be able to convince the Iranians to join an a regional consortium so they can enrich uranium for fuel together with other countries in the region the way the Europeans do, for example. Nothing is clear, but we shouldn't try to put too much on this agreement. One agreement never solves a basic problem. It is just a brick in the foundation. And having the deal gives us more time to add other bricks. One thing is for certain, we're not going to be in a worse situation 10 years from now. And without a deal, we certainly would be. Without a deal, Iran would be off to the races, and we'd be looking at allowing them to get close to building a bomb or going to war to stop them. And those alternatives are fraught with risk. Whatever risk an agreement might have for us, those risks pale in comparison to the alternatives.
Well, Joseph Cerisioni, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Joseph Cerisioni, who's the president of the Plowshares Fund and the author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He previously directed nonproliferation and international policy programs at Center for American Progress and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He also worked on the professional staffs of the House Committee on Armed Services and the Committee on Government Operations and served as staff director of the Bipartisan Military Reform Caucus. He has an article at the Huffington Post, How to Know the Iran Deal is a Good Deal. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the HBO documentary Going Clear, Scientology and the Prison of Belief. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from London is John Sweeney, an investigative journalist with the BBC's flagship television program Panorama. Previously, he worked as a newspaper journalist with 12 years at The Observer, and his latest book is The Church of Fear, Inside the Weird World of Scientology. And he is the creator of Panorama's television documentary, Scientology and Me. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Sweeney.
Hiya.
And last night, HBO screened its extraordinary film by Alex Gibney, Going Clear, Scientology and the Prison of Belief. And everybody that watched it, according to reviews and from my anecdotal information and from my own experience, it was a devastating film. It is absolutely overwhelming documentation of this extraordinarily evil operation that destroys people's lives in the name of religion and is entirely dedicated to making money, particularly for its number one protagonist that's taken over the whole organization, this fellow called Miscavige. You've already had run-ins with them, and I take it that the film itself that we're still sort of reeling from here in the United States will not be shown in the UK because of Scientology's predilection to sue under Britain's antiquated libel laws.
Hopefully, we will be able to see the HBO film Going Clear in Britain sooner rather than later. It's certainly the case that HBO have decided to show it in the States first. My old man was in the Battle of Atlantic. And I do feel delighted this film has been made, and everything I've heard, because I haven't been able to see it because of these legal restrictions, the same legal restrictions that made us edit things out of our two panoramas. When I took my book to Around Bridges Publishers, nobody would publish my book, Church of Fear, so my agent ended up becoming a publisher, and he published it instead because of our out-of-date libel laws. It feels like the Second World War. It's great that the Americans worked out the Nazis a Nazi. Fantastic they've joined in the war. Like it's that kind of moment. That's too flip a joke. But nevertheless, we're dealing with something which in Britain is not classified as a religion. Scientology to this day is not a religion. And struck me, the great, great thing about this is that there's a lot of evidence which Alex Gibney and Larry Wright have dug up and they've put out there. And it's fantastic they've done so. The thing that I'm most excited about is that Tom Cruise and John Travolta are the great ambassadors of this thing, which calls itself religion. Ex-members says it's a brainwashing cult. From now on, I don't think it would be possible for Cruise and Travolta, when they go around the world touring the green rooms and the sofas and the chat shows of all the world saying, wow, what a wonderful film I've made, blah, blah, blah. No one ever asked them about this thing they're in, this thing called the Church of Scientology, which is a little controversial. From now on, after going clear, that's not going to be possible, I hope. People are going to say, can you explain, what's your response to some of the criticisms? Because, boy, going clear was full of criticisms, and that's what's great.
Well, when you mentioned the analogies with the US finally joining World War II against the Nazis, and it's worth noting that Hitler declared war on the United States, and Churchill said that was the greatest gift that he could imagine. But, you know, without being flippant myself, there were scenes of Miscavige at these big rallies that they have where he gives these pep talks to these sort of brainwashed, you know, acolytes. And the settings, the sets themselves, with these big sort of Roman columns and torches burning, are so much like the Nazis. It is scary beyond belief.
Let's be clear and remember that I am in Britain. The church says that I am psychotic, a bigot, and a liar. A Church of Scientology blogger has said John Sweeney is genuinely evil. They dispute all of this. Nevertheless, people who've left say it's a totalitarian cult. And it's weird. I write about it in my book. Cruise played von Stauffenberg in a film about the great anti-Nazi hero, the German resistance. And the point about this is, was this really a film about von Stauffenberg, the man who dared to blow up Hitler? Or was this a film which was having a poke of modern democratic Germany's stance on Scientology? Because the most wonderful thing about Going Clear is that HBO and the people who've made it are through and through American-American. And the problem with Scientology, certainly as far as our perspective is concerned as BBC journalists, was that it was very, very difficult to get this through the mainstream media. When I made my film in 2007, if you recall, I lost my temper with Tommy Davis. I just was harassed beyond belief, and I lost my rag. I apologized then, I apologize now. And a lot of the American media, certainly people I think from Fox News, but lots of them mocked me for my foolishness. I think some suggested that I should get fired and so forth and so on. And there was a kind of weird thing that America didn't properly understand, that this, if you're the Gambino crime family, which is perhaps a better analogy than the Nazis, and you call yourself a religion, and then the tax man, the IRS, says, oh, yes, we are a religion, that they are a religion, then that's it. Then you're beyond scrutiny. It seems to me that Scientology may call itself a religion, but its practices, its harassment of critics, people like me, it's the way it treats ordinary people, the disconnection of families so that mothers can't talk to daughters, grandmas don't talk to their grandchildren. all of this has got nothing to do with the religion, and that is why it seems the British certainly do not classify Scientology as a religion. And that's one of the big issues that flows from this film, is just because something says it's a religion doesn't mean it is a religion. There has to be a better test of that. The rest of society is going to look at this thing and say, you know what? We believe in people's right to believe in things. We support that right. And then there is another thing is we also believe that this belief system and the people who adhere to it are deserving of society's respect. Therefore, that's a religion. But if this thing is aggressive, does harm, lies about what it believes in fundamentally, which I'm sure your listeners already know, but I'm going to tell them anyway. What Scientologists believe eventually, after about $1 million, 25 years inside, is that 75 million years ago, a space alien Satan called Lord Zenu brought space aliens to Earth and massacred them in volcanoes with hydrogen bombs. And the remains of these dead space alien souls have stuck to us, and they're the cause of all humanity's ills and wars and madness. And only Scientology can clear you, can clean you up of these dead, pesky space aliens. By the way, having told you that, I have effectively sentenced you to death. Everybody listening will surely die because I've said something which is so powerful and lethal, it will kill you all. To be fair, I've been saying it to millions of people through TV, through my book, and in talks in pubs in Britain for a long time, and thus far I've got a cold right now, but I'm still very much alive. So I think that is proof that this is nonsense. There is a clear point about this. In Britain, the British test is religion must be open to all, but also it must be open about itself. You go to a church and they'll tell you about baby Jesus. You go to a mosque, they'll say follow the prophet. You go to a synagogue, marry a nice Jewish girl, don't eat bacon sandwiches. You walk into a church or Scientology center and they won't tell you about the about Zenu, about the space alien Satan. So Scientology is hiding something from the people who it's sucking in. And that's wrong, because a pay-as-you-go religion isn't a religion. A religion should be free. Now, you can give some money if you like it, but you shouldn't have to pay money to find out what's next. And that's the problem. That's the logic bomb inside Scientology, I would say.
And, of course, you are in this new documentary that HBO have just screened, Going Clear, Scientology and the Prison of Belief, by Oscar-winning director Alex Gibney, based upon the book by Lawrence Wright. And Lawrence Wright, of course, is in the film as well. And you are in the film, and the scene, I think, was it Mike Rinder that was screaming at you on camera?
No. I haven't seen it because of British libel laws, but I believe, well, I'm the man who screams at Tommy Davis.
Right.
But there's a certain point, yes, well, there's a certain point. They don't run my scream, which is, it's on the internet. You can see me, if you put in Sweeney and Scientology on YouTube, you can see me yell at Tommy Davis. But it's when I say to Mike Rinder, is it true? I've heard David Miscavige, the leader of the church, has beaten you up on several occasions. Right. By the way, Miscavige and the church deny this.
Right.
And Rinder said, no, John, that's a lie. And if you print that, if you say that, if you broadcast that, I will come for you and you're in grave danger. Something like this.
Right. Well, that clip is in the film. But
yes.
Mike Rinder is also in the film. And he says, that was a complete lie. I was lying. I have been beaten up on a number of occasions by Miscavige, who puts people in the hole in one of their many sort of prisons that they have in these estates that they control. And, you know, they have these people cleaning toilets with toothbrushes, and they pay their people slave wages, and yet they are a tax-exempt organization that has massive property investments in the billions. And that's what's extraordinary about it. And I do hope that this film leads to a movement in this country to force the IRS to revoke their 501c3 nonprofit status as a church, and that might well happen. But what was powerful about the film, John Sweeney, was that almost all of the top people in Scientology are in the film now, exposing the hideous and evil nature of this organization, not just Mike Rinder, but also Marty Rathbun. And you see in the film the Scientology goons coming to their houses and harassing them on a constant basis and renting places across the street and following them with surveillance, etc. They are amazingly proactive, not just at being litigious, but in terms of really harassing people to the point where I guess it's up to the very edge of the law. Is that how they operate?
Yes. Does the Gambino crime family, would it be right and proper in the United States for the Gambino crime family to say, hey, everybody, we're no longer the Gambino crime family, we're the Church of Gambinoology, and now we're the church, you leave us alone. And it feels like that. It feels like that. There are two big weird things going on inside Scientology, both at the same time. The first is the power of the brainwashing. And I asked a guy called Bruce Hines, who is a lovely man who was in Scientology for 30 years and used to audit Tom Cruise and ISIS, I believe Bruce. And I said, were you brainwashed? And he said, yes, I was. And the reason he thought he was after he left, he went and researched brainwashing. And the great expert on brainwashing in the world is a professor, an American professor called Robert Lipton, who was an American military psychiatrist who treated American GIs who'd been brainwashed by the Chinese communists, having been caught in North Korea during the Korean Civil War. And he then wrote a book called Thought Reform or Brainwashing, which the journalist Richard Condon turned into a novel called The Manchurian Candidate, which the Israelis reversioned with a guy from an Israeli soldier who eventually became almost the top man in Israeli politics in the Knesset. And then that was repackaged by Hollywood as Homeland. It just tells you that there are only so many fictional plots in Hollywood. But what's fascinating about this is the power in the 21st century, in the digital age, in places, I'm not talking about North Korea where I've been, or Pakistan or Afghanistan where I've been, I'm not talking about those places, but in Florida and California, the ability of an entity like the Church of Scientology to brainwash people to behave in this dreadful and terrifying way. So the first thing is the power of brainwashing inside the world's greatest democracy is still a thing to behold and be afraid of. The second thing is this. I am delighted that Going Clear has been made by HBO, but why wasn't it made 7 years ago when we did our film? I'm not accusing HBO of being slow. I'm just saying the American media as a whole took a very, very long time to get around to Scientology. And the third thing is, tell me, Tom Cruise, tell me, John Travolta, why do you continue to support this thing if the evidence, which is abundant, that it does harm, is out there? Why can no entertainment journalist in the entire United States sit in front of Tom Cruise and John Travolta and say, come on, tell me a little about Scientology? Why is that not permitted? Please, American journalists, pick up your pens, pick up your skepticism, ask those questions of the stars that sell Scientology to the masses. Why are you doing what you're doing?
Well, there's an extraordinary clip in the film, in the HBO film, John Sweeney, of Tom Cruise, where he laughs maniacally at an inside Scientology joke that he's possibly an SP, which is a term they call suppressive person. And it's quite disturbing to watch. And there's also, the film makes very clear that John Travolta, that when you join Scientology, these primitive lie detector machines called e-meters record all kinds of stuff, and you make these copious confessions, all of which they put into folders, so they have enormous amounts of data and incriminating evidence on every one of their members. And apparently, the film made it pretty clear that John Travolta was afraid of the file that they had on him, revealing information about his private life and this so-called black PR package that they have. Travolta apparently refused to have his sessions videotaped, but they were secretly videotaped in any case. So this is, I think, one of the more pernicious parts of it is that that's how they control their people, is because you can't leave, otherwise they can blackmail you.
There are two big court decisions, both in 84, one in Britain, one in the United States. One mentions the word brainwashing, the other the word blackmail. So is it possible? Let's do this in a hypothetical way. And if you are homosexual or you're bisexual, and you're starting out in Hollywood in the 1970s or 1980s, and you are fabulously handsome and a man, and you know that your career as a Hollywood heartthrob depends upon you appearing to be heterosexual. If you then join an organization that effectively has, and this is what people say inside auditing, there's nothing hypothetical about this, by the way, what I'm about to say, is they ask you intimate questions, in particular about sex. What did you do? What did he, she do? What was he, she wearing? What did you do to him? What did you do to her? What did she do to you? What did he do to you? In great detail. This is recorded on tape, and I know the people who videoed it. So the question, the hypothetical question is it possible that if you're in that situation of being a homosexual man who is pretending to be heterosexual, or a bisexual man who's pretending to be heterosexual, would it frighten the life out of you if your secrets about your gay reality or your bisexuality came out? And the problem is, it's simple. You look at the Catholic Church. Many, many problems. I was brought up as a Catholic. I'm not one now. But very simply, from about the 14th century, it's been a mortal sin for a Catholic priest ever to tell anyone what happens in confession. In Scientology, there is no such thing. They say there is, but for example, one of an ex-Scientologist, somebody I like and admire, a lady called Amy Scobie, has written a wonderful book called Abuse at the Top. Her intimate sexual details were leaked by the Church of Scientology to demolish her credibility as a human being and as a critic to a newspaper, the St. Petersburg Times. And that strikes me as being wholly wrong. So if the Church sort of says, oh, no, we don't do this, oh, yes, they do. And so the question is, again, to the American media, and again, to the, in particular, the entertainment media, and Hollywood as a whole, surely you've got to go and ask Tom Cruise and John Travolta, is it possible you're not telling us the truth about this thing you're in, Scientology, because they're blackmailing you? I'm not saying it's a fact. I'm saying, can we ask the question, please?
Well, John Sweeney, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. Cheers. Good night.
Good night. And again, I've been speaking with John Sweeney, who's an investigative journalist with the BBC's flagship television program Panorama. Previously, he worked as a newspaper journalist with 12 years at The Observer. And his latest book is The Church of Fear, Inside the Weird World of Scientology. And he is the creator of Panorama's television documentary, Scientology and Me. And he joined us from London. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about Indiana Governor Mike Pence's so-called religious freedom law blowing up in his face.
Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
You may be a preacher, spiritual pride. Maybe a city councilman taking bribes on the side. Maybe working in a barber shop, you may know how to cut hair.
Ooh, love breaks the machine. Everything's half a dream, how can it be? Everything's born in shame, it's not just me. Particle wave duality. How can we ever evolve when our gods are so primitive? They destroy our hope for peace, hope for love.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Professor Marjorie Hershey, who teaches political science at Indiana State University in Bloomington. Her research focuses on political parties, campaigns, and elections. And she's the author of Party Politics in America, the Major Political Parties Text, now in its 14th edition, for which she received the American Political Science Association's Epstein Book Award for the best book on political parties. Welcome to Background Briefing, Professor Marjorie Hershey.
Thank you.
And your state of Indiana has been getting a lot of attention lately because of an effort to pass a law which is supposedly in the spirit of religious freedom, but it appears to be in many ways designed to limit the freedoms of others. And it's created a tremendous backlash and forced the governor, former Congressman Mike Spence, pretty much under the political hot seat. Now they're going back to the legislature to clarify the law. But my understanding is that that's all pretty disingenuous. All these calls from these lawmakers in Indiana saying, well, it was never meant to discriminate against anybody. The very provisions now that they're talking about to bolster the law are the very ones that were struck down when they're offered as amendments to protect minorities. So,
well, in fact, the Indiana law was sponsored by the very same legislators who sponsored the constitutional amendment proposed a couple of years ago to ban same-sex marriage in Indiana. So I think the intent of the law is clear as far as the legislature is concerned, and it certainly is with respect to the governor as well. Mike Pence has long harbored ambitions to run for the Republican presidential nomination. Some of the early Republican primaries, the Republican constituencies of primary voters have a heavy evangelical tint to them, such as Iowa and South Carolina. Pence has a number of competitors for that nomination to try to appeal to the evangelical sector of the Republican Party. Those include Senator Ted Cruz and Mike Huckabee, former governor of Arkansas, and a whole series of others. And I think that it was Pence's original intent to have this passed this year as a way to get him acknowledged as the front runner with respect to the evangelical branch of the Republican Party. The problem was that although an awful lot of people are floating stuff on social media that says, well, why the big concern right now? Because the federal government has the same law and 19 other states have the same law. That's not accurate. It's absolutely amazing how things can go viral that have absolutely no basis in fact. And anybody who reads the law would see that the Indiana law is much more vague in the way it defines religion, for example. And I think that's part of, I think that, first of all, that was what Pence and his legislative allies were hoping for, because that would be a much broader law. The problem is that one of the kinds of suits that's likely to arise is from a group of folks who believe that their religion instructs them to smoke marijuana with some frequency, and that they feel that they may be discriminated against, and so they might file suit under this law. That would really not be great publicity for Mike Pence. This is not the way he wants to have himself seen by Republican primary voters in Iowa and South Carolina. So they kind of overreached.
Well, specifically, though, and you bring up a very important point, Marjorie Hershey, and Mike Pence uses that as his defense, as do all of the defenders of this so-called religious freedom law, that they say it's no different from the federal law or the 19 states. But it is different. Section 9 of the Indiana law is quite different in as much as it says that, in other words, every other Religious Freedom Restoration Act applies to disputes between a person or entity and the government. Indiana's is the only law that explicitly applies to disputes between private citizens. So as a private citizen, you can say that your exercise of religion has been substantially burdened or is likely to be substantially burdened, and you can use the law as a claim or defense. So that makes it very, very different.
Well, and it's a really interesting thing to consider how court cases might look with respect to this. Let's say that there is a Muslim baker who refuses to bake a cake for a Jewish bar mitzvah, and the Jewish bar mitzvah person files suit in a court and says that he or she has been unfairly discriminated against on the ground of religious beliefs. What happens then? The judge has to say whether or not it is an okay thing as far as the Muslim religion is concerned to determine whether the Muslim religion in fact believes that Muslims should not serve Jews. I mean, this is what it's going to come down to, right? Is this an actual practice of the Muslim religion, or is this a misuse of the law? So we're going to basically tell judges, and I'm sure judges are the least people who want to be saddled with this responsibility, you get to decide what Islam preaches or what Judaism or Christianity preaches. And I imagine we'll end up with a bunch of court cases in which, you know, you bring your 15 Bible verses or Quran verses, and I'll bring my 15 Quran verses, and the judge will have to decide who interprets them correctly. That's nuts.
So now that this has blown up in Governor Pence's face, and I suppose in many ways we should feel good about that spontaneous response. I saw all those signs, you know, saying, you know, Hoosiers don't discriminate. And there was obviously a tremendous cross-section of people who felt sincerely offended by what they were doing. This wasn't any, you know, outside agitators, as I always like to say. This seemed like a spontaneous, homegrown rebellion. Added to which, of course, you have the head of Apple and the NCAA, the basketball people, and the big game show people for the show for gamers, you know, the techies, they were going to cancel their thing. I mean, there is, I think, a movement afoot in this country that a lot of people are just fed up with this kind of religious bigotry.
Well, I think we're going to probably get more of it, at least within the next year. That was the way that the proposed Arizona Religious Freedom Restoration Act was stopped. Finally, the governor vetoed it because of the fact that so many groups got in touch with Arizona and said, you know, you passed this thing, we're not coming. We're going to withdraw our conventions from here. We're not going to do business with Arizona. And that's already been the case with Indiana. It makes me smile that the governor is outraged at this, you know, that once the legislature does something, that people might actually have a reaction to it. They might use their freedom of expression to actually say so. The challenge now is that we have almost two-thirds of the state legislatures in the United States dominated by one party, the same party as the governor in that state. So we have unified party control in most states right now. And given the fact that the Republicans and the Democrats are fairly evenly balanced in American political preferences, that means that when you have unified party control as a party, you better move pretty fast to take advantage of it. You'd better pass your wish list just as quickly as you can, because given the close balance of power, you might lose control in 2 years when the next election is held. So we've seen state legislatures all over the country passing some pretty remarkably far out pieces of legislation that are the wish lists of one party or the other that's in control of the state government. Kansas is an amazing example of that. But that's not likely to decline anytime soon. The political polarization in American politics is pretty profound. It's probably here to stay for the foreseeable future. And we're likely to see more Indiana Religious Freedom Restoration Act cases in various other states before too long.
Well, it would seem to me that you could offer up a scenario that this is not exactly an accident, that I've always thought the Republicans are much more strategic and long-term in their thinking than the Democrats are, and Karl Rove is clearly a very clever strategist, and I'm not sure there's much on the Democratic bench in that regard, at least I'm not aware of them. And, you know, you do have gridlock, as you point out, you have gridlock in Washington. There's no question about that. But who's causing the gridlock? Arguably, yeah, it's the Republicans. But so they caused gridlock in Washington, paralyzed Washington, and then they aggressively move at the state level to fill the vacuum and get a whole bunch of stuff passed. That's what Mitch McConnell is doing to get rid of the EPA in this phony war on coal that he's talking about.
Well, it's easier to get things passed on the state level than it is on the national level. And you're right that this is not an accident. One of the reasons that it's very valuable for a number of Republican presidential prospective candidates to try to occupy the most right-wing territory for the Republican nomination is that that's where the Koch brothers are. And they have quite a lot of bags of money on that end of the spectrum along with them. And Mr. Pence has certainly been a favorite of the Koch brothers. They, like several other candidates who are on the strong right wing of the Republican Party. So there's a fair amount of financing to be had on that end. And that financing, I think, just wants to get its money's worth right now. And Citizens United, the Supreme Court case that opened up political spending to corporations and labor unions, enables them to do that.
Well, just in closing then, Professor Marjorie Hershey, the fact that Citizens responded and that this was a bridge too far, in effect, for the governor, and he pointed out that the Indiana government has political ambitions and he's sort of courting the religious vote. And, of course, it's a pretty crowded field. If he wants to enter it, go ahead. I think every day now for the next few weeks we're going to have announcements. I think Carly Fiorina is going to happen at any moment. So, as I said earlier, what I find heartening here is that people in this country, you know, at a certain point you push them too far and they react. And I'm wondering whether there could be more mobilization, if you like, for want of a better description, on the political left, against those who talk about religious freedom, but whose real agenda is to restrict the freedom of others?
You know, I think the real challenge that liberals face in American politics and everywhere else, really, is that liberals have a commitment to a level of tolerance that often prevents them from organizing very fully. In fact, I have some colleagues at Wisconsin and Nebraska who show that there are actually some physiological differences that seem to be associated with the greater tolerance level of deviance by liberals than by conservatives. And when that happens, you can get a pretty large reaction that lasts for a relatively short time. But it's the folks who don't just react in the short run who get what they want. It's the folks who organize and mobilize and have the resources to do that and who will wait and strategize right now. And then when things get quiet again, we'll come back and petition the legislature for more of these policies. So the real challenge, I think, for progressives in the United States is to still be there after the initial outrage goes away.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Professor Marjorie Hershey.
Thank you much.
And again, I've been speaking with Professor Marjorie Hershey, who teaches political science at Indiana State University in Bloomington. Her research focuses on political parties, campaigns, and elections. And she's the author of Party Politics in America, The Major Political Parties, text now in its 14th edition, for which she received the American Political Science Association's Epstein Book Award for the best book on political parties. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Molly Lewis. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.